In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen. Our Lady of Guadalupe, Eusebius of Vercelli, pray for us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Well, good morning to all of you. I'm pleased to be able to accept this invitation from His Eminence to provide one of the talks at our conference this weekend. And His Eminence asked me if I would speak on the topic of the essential preparation for marriage. And this in light of, as he explained yesterday, the talks on marriage this weekend connected to the upcoming Extraordinary Synod on the Family. The actual title of that synod is The Pastoral Challenges of Family in the Context of Evangelization. And I might point out that the synod that meets this October 2014 is the Extraordinary Synod, and then there will be the Ordinary Synod meeting 1 year later in October of 2015. Somebody asked me this morning if there are plans for prayers and coming together to pray, to surround the synod with prayer. And I said I hadn't heard of anything, not here in the Diocese of La Crosse, but they may wait for the ordinary synod for that to be done. This presentation will be given from the perspective primarily from the papal magisterium, with a great reliance on St. John Paul II's apostolic exhortation on the role of the Christian family in the modern world. His Eminence made reference to it yesterday. It was promulgated in 1981. It had been many years since I had read it, and for this presentation I went back and I reread it, and I second what the Cardinal said yesterday. It is as if it speaks to present-day realities. Of course, and we wouldn't expect to find it there, one thing that's not at all mentioned there is this movement towards so-called same-sex marriage, is that topic is not taken up, and I'm curious to see if the present synod will take up that rather difficult pastoral challenge. Also, too, I'm using St. John Paul II's letter to families. That document might not be that well known, but I'd like to recommend it to you. If you haven't read it, it's really a very, very excellent document. Also, too, the document of the truth and meaning of human sexuality from the Pontifical Council on the Family. And then, too, I read the an analysis of diocesan marriage preparation policies that is put out by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, as well as then using the policy manual from the La Crosse Diocese, which is entitled Living the Sacrament, the Imperfect Union, Living the Sacrament of Marriage. It doesn't pertain just to the Diocese of La Crosse, but all five dioceses. It's promulgated by the Wisconsin Catholic Conference that is made up of the five dioceses of La Crosse. So those are the sources that I primarily used in this presentation. St. John Paul II states in his conclusion to Familiaris Consortio, quote, "The future of humanity passes by way of the family." And that statement of his amplifies what the Second Vatican Council Fathers stated in paragraph 47 of Gaudium et Spes, quote, "The well-being of the individual person and of both human and Christian society is closely bound up with a healthy state of conjugal and family life. Preparation for marriage and for family life is of the greatest importance, important to the couple who is preparing for married life, for the church, and for society." Close quote. The decision for a man and a woman to marry is of the utmost importance, and it must not be done hastily, but only after prayerful deliberation and with the assistance offered and required by the Church. This is of particular importance today in that a great deterioration of family life and a corrosion of the value of marriage is widespread throughout our society. In years past, marriages were lived out within a supportive culture, where the failure of marriages was rare and divorce was considered to be a social plague. This is no longer the case. We are passing through a time in our nation's history where very rapidly the classical understanding of marriage as a permanent and faithful relationship between one man and one woman is not only being called into question and aggressively attacked, but is also fast losing its traditional priority in the civil law. This redefinition of marriage is taking place within the context of a culture that is becoming increasingly pagan and atheistic. If that were not enough, in addition, there is a growing disinterest and mistrust of the institutions that serve the Christian faith, with a heightened skepticism and mistrust of the Catholic Church in particular, as she seeks to correct the terrible damage done to her reputation as a consequence of the scandal of the clergy child sexual abuse. The effect of all of this has been an erosion of the importance and sacredness of marriage and family life among the general populace, including the Catholic faithful. So when a couple comes to the church for the sacrament of marriage, it presents a very important opportunity for evangelization. Their desire, a young couple's desire to celebrate the sacrament of marriage, indicates that while these couples live in this increasingly hostile culture, nevertheless, they are exhibiting a certain degree of faith that can lead them to a deeper understanding of love and love of Christ and His church. And this is an opportunity for evangelization that must be fully realized. The Church, through her magisterial teaching, recognizes this opportunity and provides directions to national bishops' conferences, to diocesan bishops, and to various diocesan entities, including parishes, that are entrusted with the essential preparation for marriage and family life. And this new evangelization is to be grounded in the realization that a couple brings into being by their marriage a new ecclesial reality, the communion of the family, which is also known as the domestic church. Quote from Familiaris Consortio, paragraph 21. Conjugal communion constitutes the foundation on which is built the broader communion of the family, of parents and children, of brothers and sisters with each other, of relatives and other members of the household. The Christian family is called to experience a new and original communion which confirms and perfects natural and human communion. The Christian family constitutes a specific revelation and realization of ecclesial communion, and for this reason, too, it can and should be called the domestic church. Close quote. And here I would just offer a personal reflection from my own pastoral ministry as a parish priest. I think I have found this to be a very, very positive way to talk to young couples when they come for marriage, to talk to them about the fact that they are going to form what the church herself calls a domestic church. And often couples will come with a little bit of suspicion based on what I just mentioned, a little suspicion about, you know, church, the institutional church. But when I talk with them about the fact that they are going to form a church with their marriage, and if God blesses that marriage with children, that they are going to be an expression, a true and legitimate expression of the church called the domestic church, I have found them to respond very positively to that concept. It's like, well, we can get involved in this game. You know, they seem to be kind of messing it up there on the diocesan level, you know, but here's an opportunity for us. And that's what I try to kind of probe with them. You bring a new freshness to the experience of church with your marriage and with your family. And I think if we can kind of hook them there, then it, of course, the domestic church cannot exist without being involved with the parish church, which is the church that's made up of many domestic churches, many families. So immediately it moves them in that direction of the parish church, and through the connection with the parish church, then of course they're connected with a particular church, which is called the diocese, and then the universal church. You know, I think all of us, we have a particular love for our diocesan church and the universal church, our parish church. That can't be assumed with young people today. They have a kind of suspicion. They keep a kind of a distance. They're unsure if they, you know, not all couples, of course, but many who come are, you know, that they want their marriage to take place in the church, but as far as being committed to it and loving the church, that's not a priority for them. Preparation of a couple for marriage begins with the degree of faith that they possess. And this can be determined, and this is the way I determine it, through an honest conversation with them about their prayer life, as well as their commitment to the sacramental life of the church. And if their faith is weak or it's non-existent, then this must be addressed. This is from Familiaris Consortio, paragraph 68, quote, "In fact, the faith of the person asking the church for marriage can exist in different degrees, and it is the primary duty of pastors to bring about a rediscovery of this faith and to nourish it and bring it to maturity," close quote. And it's recommended in the Apostolic Exhortation of Familiaris Consortio that pastors offer what it calls a journey of faith for couples, similar to the catechumenate, whereby a presentation of the fundamental truths of the faith are presented within the context of prayerful discernment over time. Quote, "Marriage preparation has to be seen and put into practice as a gradual and continuous process. It includes three main stages: remote, proximate, and immediate preparation," close quote. That's paragraph 66 of the Apostolic Exhortation. And those three stages, I'm going to focus in on each of those stages, the remote, the proximate, and the immediate preparation periods. This formative journey should include, one, a deepening of personal faith based in authentic doctrinal content. Second, rediscovery of the value and the necessity of the sacraments. And thirdly, a personal relationship with Christ through prayer. Also, it is to include the study of conjugal sexuality based on sound scientific knowledge, as well as the correct method of education of children and the formation of a home where the virtues inform family life. It should be noted that by describing marriage preparation as a journey, that journey does not come to an end with the celebration of the rite of marriage, but it continues on in and through family life. St. John Paul II specifically addresses those situations that are not infrequently encountered by pastors when a couple comes for marriage preparation, and either one or both of them possess minimal faith and minimal understanding of the content of the faith. He indicates that while these persons are, and these are his words, imperfectly disposed, they are to be welcomed and encouraged to engage in the journey that will eventually lead to the celebration of marriage. Pope John Paul II explains why pastors are not to turn away from marriage those who are imperfectly disposed. Quote from paragraph 68. "The sacrament of matrimony has this specific element that distinguishes it from all the other sacraments. It is the sacrament of something that was part of the very economy of creation. It is the very conjugal covenant instituted by the Creator in the beginning. Therefore, the decision of a man and woman to marry in accordance with this divine plan, that is to say, the decision to commit by their irrevocable conjugal consent their whole lives in indissoluble love and unconditional fidelity, really involves, even if not in a fully conscious way, an attitude of profound obedience to the will of God, an attitude which cannot exist without God's grace. They have thus already begun what is in a true and proper sense a journey towards salvation. Close quote. I think that's a rather profound statement, profound insight regarding the sacrament of marriage. The Holy Father then goes on to address another situation that many pastors encounter with couples, that being that they often approach marriage more for social reasons than they do for religious or spiritual reasons. Again, he cautions pastors not to judge negatively a couple who presents themselves for marriage motivated by reasons that are more social than religious. And I quote, "It is true that in some places engaged couples ask to be married in church for motives which are social rather than genuinely religious. This is not surprising. Marriage, in fact, is not an event that concerns only the persons actually getting married. By its very nature, it is also a social matter, committing the couple being married in the eyes of society. It therefore goes without saying that social as well as personal motives enter into the requests to be married in church. Nevertheless, it must not be forgotten that these engaged couples, by virtue of their baptism, are already really sharers in Christ's marriage covenant with the church, and that, by their right intention, they have accepted God's plan regarding marriage, and therefore at least implicitly consent to what the church intends to do when she celebrates marriage. Thus, the fact that motives of a social nature also enter into the request is not enough to justify refusal on the part of the pastors." You'll find that in paragraph 68. Now, that having been said, the Holy Father does acknowledge those difficult situations when a couple will not be admitted to marriage. Quote, "However, when in spite of all efforts, engaged couples show that they reject explicitly and formally what the church intends to do when the marriage of baptized persons is celebrated, the pastor of souls cannot admit them to the celebration of marriage. In spite of his reluctance to do so, he has the duty to take note of the situation and to make it clear to those concerned that in these circumstances, it is not the church that is placing an obstacle in the way of the celebration that they are asking for, but themselves." Close quote. Now, I'll just use that kind of as a preface to then going into more specific matters of preparation, those three stages of preparation that St. John Paul II mentioned in paragraph 66. And those stages, again, are remote, proximate, and immediate. And these stages are not rigidly defined either in relation to the age of the participants nor in relation to the duration of each stage. Rather, they're useful for determining where the different content of preparation is made available. So, first, the remote preparation. This preparation takes place within the family in which a person grows to maturity as a young adult. This includes infancy, childhood, and adolescence, and takes place within the family, the domestic church. The domestic church possesses a necessary relationship to the church where Christ is encountered in the sacraments, that being the particular church of the diocese, or it's, as it's expressed in the parish. Also, the particular church of the diocese and the parish assists parents of the domestic church with the formation and education of their children through the Catholic school that the parish may provide and religious education. Parents have the grave responsibility of making certain that their children receive an authentic formation and education in the Catholic faith. This is from paragraph 16 of the Holy Father's letter to families. quote, "Parents are the first and most important educators of their own children, and they also possess a fundamental competence in this area. They are educators because they are parents," close quote. Also in his letter to the families, St. John Paul II mentions two fundamental truths that are to inform this essential task of the education of children. Quote, "First, that man is called to live in truth and love, and second, that everyone finds fulfillment through the sincere gift of self," close quote. A child's education begins before birth, in an atmosphere in which the new life is awaited and welcomed, especially to the mother's loving dialogue with the child. That's found in paragraph 16 of the letter to the families. This continues in the earliest days of the newborn child by the parents recognizing that the child is the fruit of their mutual gift of love. The remote stage of preparation also involves an integral education that, quote, "not only develops the maturity of the human person, but is especially directed towards ensuring that those who have been baptized, as they are gradually introduced to a knowledge of the mystery of salvation, become daily more appreciative of the gift of faith which they have received. They should be trained to live their own lives in the new self, justified and sanctified through the truth." And that is a quote from Blessed Pope Paul VI's Declaration on Christian Education. This is the period when the formation of the character begins, this remote period. It is in this period that sexual differentiation is to be understood and appreciated, with a corresponding learned respect for persons of the opposite sex. It is also the time when self-control is learned and self-esteem is developed. Obviously, children best learn the values that form their character by observing it being modeled by their mother and their father. It is in this remote period of preparation that a faithful education in chastity and love as self-giving is to be presented to children and youth. The sexual education that a child receives from his or her parents in the first years of childhood and adolescence is important. And on this matter, I refer you to the document Truth and Meaning of Human Sexuality from the Pontifical Council on the Family. Among many other important points that this document makes, and if you've never read that Truth and Meaning of Human Sexuality, I would encourage you to do so. But it underscores the primacy of parents in providing their child's education in sexuality, which often involves delicate and sensitive matters. Now, other people can assist parents in this particular education, but only with the explicit permission and the oversight of parents. That is made very, very clear. And sadly, some years ago, I think much of it has stopped, but many years ago, and it was found in religious education programs, Catholic religious education programs in Catholic schools, there were textbooks that were published that presented very, very sensitive and delicate information, and parents were not allowed to opt their children out of it because it was kind of under the purview of pastors who said, well, we kind of know what's best from a Catholic perspective for your children, and so there's nothing going on here that is wrong or indelicate and so forth. It was false. It was really scandalous. Now, and some of these, sadly, these textbooks that were used had imprimaturs, too, from bishops. So that gave even a stronger reason for pastors of parishes to say, look, you know, this can be used because right here it says that this is all right. And I know in La Crosse there were parents who fought against it and ultimately succeeded to a certain extent in being able to have the situation addressed. But it was a battle for a long time. And of course, this is a real problem when parents utilize public education to assist them in the education of their children, because there is no sensitivity at all in terms of the age of innocence of a child. So if you arrived in the fourth grade, you all take out, you listen to this or take out your book, and we're going to read about this, whether the fourth grader is ready for it or has been prepared in any way. So it's just assumed that everyone is on the same level. And of course they're not. When it comes to matters of sexuality, every person is there's a uniqueness to each person, especially to children. And you parents know that one of your children who maybe was 10 or 11 years old would be ready for a discussion about certain matters, but not your second child who's 10 or 11, they're not ready yet. Well, who is able to determine that? Who's able to know those children the best but the parents? Parents are the ones who know that. And this, the truth and meaning of human sexuality clearly states that. It's got the anthropology correct. And so if any of you are running into this, in your diocese or parishes and so forth, you should read this document and try to bring it to bear on the situation. This remote preparation includes parents instilling within their children the ability to make right judgments regarding the hierarchy of values needed in choosing what is offered within the popular culture. Children must be taught by their parents to possess the ability to critically judge their surroundings, as well as to possess the wisdom and courage of living in the world without belonging to the world. A rightly formed conscience must be instilled in children and youth. And parents can and should expect assistance from their pastors in carrying out this important duty. The example of parents living out their Christian faith within family life is essential in the preparation of those whose vocation it will be to be married. Most important is their realization that the human love shared between their parents and within the family is a sharing in as well as a sign of the love that eternally exists between Christ and the church. Now, I could say much more about this remote period of preparation, but to be fair to the other two periods of preparation, I need to move on. Suffice it to say that young people will be best prepared for marriage and family life when they grow up in a family where the love of God through prayer and the sacramental life has priority, where they witness their parents truly loving one another, and where they have received a Christian education and formation in the faith and the virtues. With the deterioration of the classical expression of the family, this remote preparation is greatly challenged. Now, the proximate preparation. This period of preparation takes place during the period of engagement, the formal engagement. It consists of specific courses offered by the church in the diocese or in the parish. It is distinguished from immediate preparation, which is usually consecrated during the final meetings between the engaged and the celebrant, and possibly others who are assisting the couple at the time of the celebration of the sacrament. It is most beneficial if the proximate preparation period begins 12 to 18 months before the celebration of marriage. The minimum amount of time for this preparation is 6 months, according to our diocesan policy. And I think that's fairly uniform throughout the church, that, or at least in the United States, that you have to present yourself at least a minimum of 6 months prior to the celebration of marriage. In this period, it is important for those preparing for marriage to indicate that marriage is truly their life's vocation. During the remote preparation period, young people should have been encouraged to discern their God-given vocation through their own prayerful discernment and with the help of the Christian community and above all with the assistance of their pastors. This discernment is to have taken place before any commitment is made to get engaged. So young people should have been encouraged to reflect very deeply on whether or not God is calling them to perhaps the consecrated life or to the priesthood. During this period, discernment of the maturity of each of the individuals in terms of their ability to enter into a meaningful relationship with one another through genuine friendship and dialogue is to take place. And there are various instruments available in the form of inventories that can be used for this discernment. The one that is used here in the Diocese of the Cross is called FOCUS, F-O-C-C-U-S. The acronym for Facilitating Open Communication, Understanding, and Study. And these diagnostic instruments will often involve other married couples or individuals who assist in discussing the results of that inventory with the couple. I just listed so that you might know, some of you might be very familiar with this, some of you may not, the categories that are covered in this focus inventory or interview. They are lifestyle expectations, friends and interests, personality match, personal issues, communication, problem solving, religion and values, parenting issues, extended family issues, sexuality issues, financial issues, readiness, marriage covenant. And then there's also questions for if there's an interfaith marriage or it's a second marriage. I find this focus instrument to be helpful. And I go over, I know a lot of people turn it to priests, and there's nothing wrong with that, turn it over to couples to discuss the results with the couples, but I do it personally. First of all, it's a way for me to really focus in with a couple on things where I might sense that there's some issues that need to be discussed. The other thing I find about this focus interview, couples like it. So they have to go into a separate rooms and they have to take it, and it's, you know, 160 questions. They fill in these little dots, and then when they come back the next time, you know, I have it scored for them, and they're actually excited. They want to know about themselves, and then they want to know about their future spouse, you know, and they often say, you know, during the week waiting for the results, they would come out, now what did you answer for that question? What do you answer for this question? You know, and there's just a good healthy curiosity and desire to want to know themselves and the others. So I find it to be a very helpful tool. Young people need to become aware of any psychological and or emotional shortcomings that they may have, especially in their ability to relate to others and any forms of selfishness that can take away from making a total commitment of self-giving. Today, as we know, there is a plague of various addictions that needs to be talked about, such as alcohol, drugs, gambling, pornography, inordinate buying and selling. And that's why I said, that's why I like to go over those the results of that focus with the couples myself, because I want to probe where I might sense, and I just come right out and ask couples, you know, what kind of drinking do they do? I ask them, you know, have you ever been drunk? Oh, they kind of laugh, you know, and so forth. Oh yeah, when I was in college, you know, I used to do crazy things, you know. Well, I want to know how those crazy things ended, you know, and it really requires, and I always point out to them that what goes on here between us, it's with very strict confidentiality. So I'm not gonna, you talk about something here, I'm not gonna go and talk to the police about it. If you're telling me that you've used drugs, illegal drugs in the past and so forth, or I'm not gonna go and tell your parents or something like that. But we need to have a very, very frank and open discussion about these things. And sometimes I have found that, you know, the couples are finding out sometimes new things about the other. One is finding out something new about the other, and that's it's important for them to know. Also, too, and this was brought up to us, I wasn't completely surprised by it, but he went on to make a very firm point about this, and the fathers who are here from the diocese might remember this. I think it was during Priest Unity Days when Bishop Callahan, he was talking about preparation for marriage. He was talking about the importance of talking to couples about their previous sexual experiences, you know, with other persons, that most couples are coming in with that kind of experience. And I just simply asked, and I don't would like to probe into all kinds of things, but I asked them, have you talked to each other about, do you know who you've been with, and that this person's been with, and that person's been with, and how long, and so on, what went on? I feel that they just simply need to know that there's just a matter of health, you know, I mean, in terms of the communicable diseases that are spread, you know, with multiple partners and so forth. I mean, a person has a right to know whether or not they could possibly be infected by their future spouse. So anyway, it is a kind of a delicate conversation, but I think it's one that has to be done. Also, the scandal of cohabitation and the sin of premarital sexual activity, fornication, must be dealt with forthrightly during this period of preparation. And I don't have time in this address to talk that much about cohabitation. However, I want to point out what the diocesan guidelines for the Wisconsin Conference says about cohabitation. It notes that it makes note of the fact that cohabitation does not do away with the right to marry. And this is from the clergy guide of Imperfect Union Living the Sacrament of Marriage. Quote, if a couple cannot or will not separate, preparation is to continue. However, a delay must be advised if the couple does not show sufficient awareness of the essential commitments of marriage. Each case must be taken on its own merits, and each case must be dealt with pastorally. Cohabitation in itself is not a canonical impediment to marriage. While canon law never supersedes conscience, those priests or deacons who choose not to witness the marriage of cohabitating couples must realize they do not have canon law to support them. If a priest or deacon cannot, in conscience, continue with the marriage, he is to refer the couple to another priest or deacon. Close quote. I'm going to ask His Eminence about that. If canon law does not support a priest, in terms of anyway, well, that's another matter. During this proximate period of preparation, couples are to come to a greater awareness and understanding of God's plan for marriage and the family. This is to include an understanding that conjugal love is total, exclusive, faithful, and fruitful. This involves education and formation concerning freedom of consent as the foundation of their union, the unity and indissolubility of marriage, the conjugal act with its requirements and ends, the concepts of responsible parenthood, and the proper education of children. It is in this period when the engaged couple is to become informed concerning natural methods for the regulation of fertility. It is on this point that we can also witness another, or it's on this point that we can witness an important intersection between the formation that is done in the remote period and with this proximate period, in that the virtue of chastity that an individual is to be practicing in his or her youth now provides the foundation to practice periodic continence within their marriage. By teaching the regulation of birth through a moral means, natural family planning, another opportunity for evangelization presents itself. And I require all of my couples to take the course in natural family planning, and it's made easier now because you can take the course, a certified course, online, which young couples like to do. They have all this social media savvy, and so they do that. And I use it as a point of evangelization. I think couples come, not only do they come with the suspicion of the church at times, but they also come with a heightened desire to take care of our environment. Yeah, that's a good thing. And very often they're suspicious of chemicals, you know, that are being poured into the environment and so forth. And so I speak about it in those terms of, you know, what about the chemicals going into the environment of your body? And what is that doing? And what if you knew that there is something natural that doesn't require that? And well, I see them. They listen. And to point out to them that this is based, and this is another important thing, because there's this false dichotomy that many young people are living with. Especially they've gone through university courses and so forth, that, you know, faith and reason are diametrically opposed. And so religion is the enemy of science. I mean, that's just, you know, presumed in most college courses. And so couples kind of come with that, you know, this faith stuff, this religion stuff, you know, that's over here, and then science is over here. So you say that here is the church using the best science, and this is what is going to be imparted to you is knowledge of your bodies, knowledge of how the fertility cycle works. And this is something, once you learn it, that's the nature of knowledge. It doesn't cost you anything anymore. You know, you've got it for the rest of your life if you keep it up and keep refreshing it, rather than having to constantly go over to Planned Parenthood and buy all of this expensive stuff that you put into your bodies or place between the two of you. However, speaking about natural family planning, it must be presented from the perspective of marriage chastity and not simply from lessons in anatomy or biology. So, I mean, while you can speak about what I just talked about in, I think, a rather convincing and fresh way to young people, you do have to talk about the fact that this involves the virtue of chastity. And so the presentation on natural family planning must include the discussion that they are to practice chaste natural family planning, meaning that abstinence must be faithfully embraced and not gotten around by sinful behaviors such as masturbation or sodomy or withdrawal. Also, too, natural family planning cannot be used for selfish purposes by the couple, choosing to use it in order to close themselves off to bringing forth a new life. A couple is supposed to have a good reason why they are not going to utilize the opportunity for fertility. There have been comparative studies done regarding the use of natural family planning and the use of artificial birth control, and one that was done by a Mercedes Wilson is one that I often use in my homilies, in marriage homilies. And in her conclusion, she states this: the natural family planning respondents have a dramatically low 2% divorce rate, are happier and more satisfied in their everyday lives, share a deeper intimacy with their spouse, realize a deeper level of communication with their spouse, attend church more often, and preserve the family unit more responsibly than the other groups. I always point that out. I say, you know, right now, here we are on a Saturday afternoon, and there's weddings going on all over the United States. And right now, the statistics show that 50% of those marriages today that are going on today are going to end up in divorce. Now, here is something that's telling you that 2 out of 100 end up in divorce. What group do you want to belong to? It seems pretty clear that, you know, that the church has got it right in this regard. Also, the engaged couple is to be informed and committed to the values concerning the defense of human life. Becoming the domestic church, they also become the sanctuary of life. That's from Evangelium Vitae. They are to be people of life and for life. Formation is needed today so that members of new families will not conform to the prevailing contraceptive mentality, but instead embrace a mentality of generosity towards others, beginning with being generous and bringing forth new life into the world. Married couples, through their new family, the new family they form, will make an essential contribution toward the development of the culture of life. This proximate period is also to involve a deepening of the faith, especially regarding the sacramentality of the Church. This is to be more than simply becoming familiar with the marriage rite. It is to include an understanding that their spousal love will become a concrete expression, a lived sacramental sign in the world of Christ's love for his spouse, the Church. Preparation of the engaged should include their being exposed through good catechesis to the dynamism of the sacraments, with a particular emphasis on the sacraments of reconciliation and the Holy Eucharist. In Canon 1065, in the Code, and in paragraph 1622 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, it's urged that couples approach the sacrament of penance in order to receive the sacraments of marriage fruitfully. This period also provides the opportunity for the couple to develop a better understanding of the vitality of baptism and confirmation. And it sometimes happens that one or both of those who are Catholics may not be confirmed when they present themselves for marriage. This proximate period provides an opportunity for this to be accomplished. This is why coming 12 to 18 months before marriage is important. During this time of proximate preparation, it is encouraged that engaged couples interact with married couples who are committed to the faith and the moral teaching of the Church and who have a joyful view of marriage. They should meet in an atmosphere of dialogue, friendship, and prayer. And this can happen, for example, through what is known as the couple-to-couple program, where a young engaged couple is assigned to a married couple, and they meet together over a series of meetings to prepare for their marriage, as well as what is known as pre-cana, which is a day-long period of prayer, teaching, and couple-to-couple interaction. Finally, a recommendation that is promoted in the Wisconsin Catholic Conference Marriage Policy Manual is the using of the order for the blessing of an engaged couple, which can be done by a priest or a deacon at Mass, or it can be done by a layperson outside of Mass. So then, just to turn to the immediate preparation, this is not quite so long. The immediate preparation, this period would include the last few months before the wedding celebration itself. Provided that a suitable preparation has been carried out in the proximate formation period, the immediate period of preparation would consist of a synthesis of the doctrinal, moral, and spiritual content of the proximate period, filling in any gaps that may exist. This is a time for more intensified prayer through a retreat experience or spiritual exercises that deepens the engaged couple's encounter with the Lord. This period is when the liturgical preparation takes place for the celebration of the rite of marriage. The couple should be exposed to the rite of marriage and take an active part in preparing the marriage celebration by their reading and studying the various optional prayers and nuptial blessings that can be chosen. The principle of lex orandi, lex credendi applies here. That is, what the Church prays is what the Church teaches. So anytime you can get anybody who's celebrating any sacramental rite to sit down and study and read the rite, what is being prayed is what we believe, and it's what the Church is teaching. So there's great benefit in couples preparing the rite. And the Church gives a number of optional prayers and blessings that rite. And they should be the ones who make those choices. It requires them to sit down. There's usually three options, three different masses that can be prayed. And I put the onus on them. You choose which mass is going to be prayed, A, B, or C, in the Roman Missal. That requires them to sit down and read all of those prayers. And I think perhaps, you know, many of them would choose, well, we'll just take A, because it's the first one. So, but there are some that do sit down and read them all, and that's a good thing. Their involvement in planning the nuptial celebration are opportunities for them to become more familiar with the sacramental dimension of the Church. They are, after all, the ministers during the rite of marriage, in that they are not married by the priest or the deacon, but they confer upon each other the sacrament of marriage by expressing their consent before the church, who is represented by the celebrant, who is either a bishop, priest, or deacon. Now, it can frequently happen that the proximate period of preparation has been done poorly or minimally, and so the immediate period is required to accomplish a great amount. That's especially true if there has been very little, if any, remote preparation. And very often that's the case. Young couples are coming, and they are coming from homes that have experienced divorce, where they've moved back and forth growing up, you know, visiting mom, visiting dad here. That whole remote preparation that I talked about, you know, where you know you observe the fidelity of your parents and so forth, all of that is missing. All that is missing, and now they come, and there they are, and you as a pastor or pastoral team have to address this. When a couple comes 6 months prior to their wedding date with little or no understanding of the various aspects of marriage, but they do come positively disposed toward receiving the sacrament, they should not experience any kind of rejection. Those in charge of assisting them, particularly the pastors, simply must work harder. And that's the case. It's extra work with those couples. Now, I'm going to go just to the rehearsal. There's many different things that could be talked about in this immediate period. But the rehearsal can also be an opportunity for evangelization with those to be in the wedding party as witnesses, for them to understand that they are there for more than just a juridical act, but as representatives of the Christian community. Now, witnesses of marriage do not have the same requirements as godparents and like at baptism and sponsors at confirmation. So they are witnesses, and therefore they do not have to be in full communion with the church. And so it is during the rehearsal that I always find out kind of where people are at in terms of who are Catholic and who are not. Because I want to take the time at the rehearsal to explain to them why they are not going to be admitted to Holy Communion. And I tell you, I've been 30 years a priest, and it's been the last 10 years that I finally, I think, figured out a way to explain this to couples without them kind of rolling their eyeballs, saying, well, you're just elitist. You Catholics are just elitist. You Catholics are just inhospitable, you know, because we go to other churches and they invite us up and so forth. So here's my little thing that I use. I say, it is out of respect of your religion that you are not invited up to receive Holy Communion. Because when you come and receive Holy Communion, in the Catholic faith, when you present yourself for Holy Communion, you are publicly professing that you believe and accept everything that the Catholic Church teaches, believes, and accepts. In other words, if you go to Holy Communion tomorrow at the Mass, you are going to be making a public proclamation that you are a Catholic. Well, that's not true. That's not true. So it's out of respect the fact that you are a Methodist. I'm respecting the fact that you are a Lutheran or a Methodist or a Baptist by not inviting you up to Holy Communion. And they kind of sit there and they seem to get it. Anyway, it seems to make an impression on them. And I might just point out, too, that there has to be a clear indication to the congregation that gathers for the Mass, especially if that non-Catholics are not admitted to Holy Communion. Usually people have those programs and we have it printed in there. I often make a statement right before I leave the altar to give out Holy Communion. I'll say, those who are in full communion with the Catholic Church and who are properly disposed are now invited to come forward for Holy Communion. So that's just my little spiel that I've developed over the years. And this is why the church doesn't ordinarily recommend that a mixed marriage is done within the context of the Mass. It can be done, but ordinarily it's not done, because there is this historical division that has divided the church, and what you're doing is you're introducing that historical division into this really a celebration of unity, and it's no fault of the couple that this historical division took place. And so to have you know, half of the congregation coming up for Holy Communion and half of it not, is just a kind of a countersign as to what is being proclaimed. I just want to conclude, and we're right up against the hour here. I'll conclude with just a reflection on the immediate preparation from a statement from the Pontifical Council of Families, and it's certainly appropriate for the audience here today. Quote, "The preparation of the engaged should be accompanied by a sincere and deep devotion to Mary, Mother of the Church, the Queen of the Family. The engaged themselves should be taught to recognize that Mary's presence is as active in the family, the domestic church, as it is in the wider church. Likewise, they should be taught to imitate Mary in her virtues. Thus, the Holy Family, the home of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, makes the engaged discover how sweet and irreplaceable education in the family is." And that final statement, "how sweet and irreplaceable education," is a quote from Pope Paul VI, Blessed Pope Paul VI, at his discourse at Nazareth. Now, I'm just going to take 2 minutes and make some practical suggestions to Marian catechists. You've listened to this very patiently, so what do we do? Well, you can see how critical it is, marriage preparation is, because it's at the heart of the family, and the family is the way of civilization, is what St. John Paul II states, and rightfully so. So if there's a place that we want to dig in as Marian catechists to try to do something that's going to affect some good in the church and the wider society, it's right here. Well, I think in that remote preparation, and His Eminence mentioned it last evening, you know, the home study course. I mean, if we can get the home study course being done in the homes, there you have a good piece of that remote preparation taking place. Imagine moms and dads taking the home study course. Well, if they're doing a home study course and children are going to school and they're doing homework at the same time parents are doing a home study course, I mean, you can see how that's going to galvanize the family together and the interest that the children are going to take in that. Mom and dad are studying. They're studying their faith. I mean, that's going to be a lifelong memory, and that's going to make a deep effect. So anything that we can do to promote the home study course within families, I think, is a very good thing. Also, being involved in pro-life work and witnessing publicly to life is very, very important in terms of the family and marriage and family. Also, the promotion of chastity programs within your parish or especially within youth ministry. Should you just inquire as to what is being taught to the youth? Is anything being taught to the youth in regards to the youth gatherings? Is it all just social? I mean, that's a very, very important part of youth gatherings, that you go out and hike and you can go and do things that are physical and fun and so forth. That's a time that young people are rambunctious and so forth. But there's also a time when you sit down and you have some very, very serious talks and discussions, and chastity should be part of it. If you can become part of a pre-Cana group in your parish or in your deanery or in your diocese, now that requires your spouse being part of that. That's a very, very important thing, because you have to have couples in pre-Cana who are living according to the church's teaching on all aspects of sexuality. That you must have that present in those couples, or otherwise you end up with a counter witness. Also, to prepare couples for, I talked about the engagement blessing. I mean, as a pastor, I'd love for somebody to come and say, "Hey, Father, you know, I'd be willing to meet with if you've got a list of those who are going to be who are engaged and who are receiving marriage preparation, I'd be willing to meet with them and kind of set up, find out time when they all can show up on which Sunday Mass, and then you can have the blessing of them." Something like that would be a big help. Promotion of natural family planning programs, and possibly even becoming a certified counselor yourself. And then finally, defending the sacredness and the integrity of marriage whenever and wherever possible. And so we have to fight mightily in the face of all of these aberrations that are taking place in terms of marriage and family life. So That brings to a conclusion my presentation. I hope there was something there that is able to help you a little bit. Thank you.